AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Do you have something you want to share? If not, I have something I pulled off of someone's Facebook page.
Pull it off.
Okay, well, it's consider it already pulled. Apparently, is that your side?
Yep.
Okay.
I'm on mute.
Apparently, we're recording this, October 4th. On September 30th, it's Treaty Day. And I didn't know what Treaty Day was, but on September 30th, 1854, the Anishinaabe, can you tell I practiced that? The Anishinaabe of Lake Superior entered into a treaty with the United States signed at La Pointe. This treaty formally abandoned the removal policy by establishing permanent homelands for the Chippewa in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. So before the treaty of 1854 despite several earlier treaties, the U.S. government attempted to eliminate or remove all tribes to locations west of the Mississippi River with the passage of the Indian Removal Act signed by President Jackson in 1830, which is super sad. And I think that's kind of also what led to like the whole Trail of Tears thing and just brutality. Like, they were here first. Why can't we just leave them alone? But President Fillmore rescinded the Indian removal orders and agreed that the Ojibwa would never be required to leave their homelands, and the Treaty of 1854 would forever change the Anishinaabe and other tribes of the area. So it's a good thing. It's a good thing to celebrate, and I found that out recently. Andrew had to step away to quiet a dog down, but yeah, I thought that was kind of cool to share. Relatively close to when this is coming out, and definitely closer to when we're recording this. So happy belated Treaty Day to everybody who was affected by it. So we can slowly hope that we become better as a country with time, even though that seems to be a little hopeful at the moment versus actual. But yeah, did you shoot it?
It's quiet now. It doesn't matter what happened.
Gosh.
It's a neighbor dog barking at another dog that's way off in the distance. Just silly.
I figured it wasn't Denny. Did you yell at it?
I was going to, but then it just stopped.
You just mean mugged it?
And it's even, like, I didn't see it.
I feel a force of something that hates me right now.
I just can't stand that dog. It's always barking.
Oh, that's annoying.
Yeah. Anyway.
So, yeah. You'll
for
get
now
to learn
it's
about
quiet.
That's good. We'll try to keep it that way. Thanks for your contribution to that. So we just learned about Treaty Day. You can learn about it when the episode comes out.
I'm excited to hear all about it.
So, yes, happy belated Treaty Day to everybody.
Hello!
Oh, wait.
And welcome to the Under the Waves podcast, a show about all things treaties and shipwrecks and things of that nature and barking dogs on the Great Lakes and beyond. My name is Andrew.
And I'm Michelle, your captain for today's entertainment. Welcome aboard this week's episode. I hate that I have to just like wait for you to say something, like to start us off, because I never know when you're going to do it. And I'm uncomfortable with silence.
It's
so,
so much fun. It's one of my favorite things I look forward to whenever we do these little recordings.
Oh, man. Well, I'm glad it caused you joy. And if you hear tippy-tappies in my background, I'm watching a dog who is very needy right now and doesn't want to be left alone. So just a heads up. At least she's not barking.
Yet.
Don't have you? Did I send you a video of this one barking? She sounds like an old man. She's like,
nope. I don't think I want to.
Old man trying to cough or something. It's just she barks really weird. I probably described that really horrendously. I might cut it anyways, but yeah, she's got not a great bark. It's terrifying the first time I heard it.
Can't all have a good bark. Maybe her bite's better.
I don't want to find that out. Anywho, we do have a captain's correction corner. We weren't sure the exact number of shipwrecks around Pilot Island last time, so we tried to do a bit of clarifying with that. In the Death Store area, there are apparently 240 shipwrecks, but technically 3 specific vessels around Pilot Island herself. So granted, we did cover one that sank on the south side of where Keeper Martin Knudsen walked out to help rescue the sailors. I'm going to stick with 4 being around the island because of that one, because if it's within walking distance, I count it as being part of the island. But most sources say 3 technically, and then more in Death's Door area. So,
is there a cutoff of time for walking? Because, I mean, technically Lake Superior is walking distance from here.
I mean, you know what? That is a point. That is...
But I get what you're saying. Yeah.
So it's surrounded by every single shipwreck in the world is what we're going to go with. Yeah. But yeah, it's... She might have to go out. Hang on. 1 minute. Elevator music. She looked at me like, why is it raining?
Why have you done this to me?
The look of betrayal. Okay. For this week's episode, we are back in Lake Michigan, and we promise we'll show some of the lower and eastern lakes a little bit more love in the next few episodes. No neglect to you, just saving the best for last. Or, I mean, not like last, we're not done yet. We just, you're not getting rid of us that easily, but this shipwreck was just recently found, and our researcher was too excited not to cover it. So here we are. And just so you know, this announcement is so new that not all the sources we used for today's episode have been updated to say that she's been found. So this is like super fresh off the press.
But sweet. Like, you heard it here first.
Hot news for the cold weather. Well, I don't know if you heard it here first, but hopefully, maybe. Can you imagine if we're like their first news source? Oh my gosh, are we news? No, I don't think we're news. Hobby news. Hobbyist news? I don't know. If you saw our social media stories last week, we actually posted about this ship. That's right, folks. We're covering the F.J. King. Allegedly, one of the most elusive shipwrecks in Lake Michigan, according to a Popular Mechanics article. The F.J. King, which sank in 1886, was found again on June 28th, 2025. I don't know why I said 2025. I mean, it makes sense, but no one says it that way. And it was found by Brendan Baylod and a group from the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association, or WUAA. And get this, after almost 139 years of people searching for this lost ship, Baylod and the WUAA found it in just about 2 hours on their second pass over their designated search area. Baylod said it, quote, was hidden in plain sight, right where it was supposed to be, end quote. But more on that later.
Absolutely incredible.
I think I'd be mad if I was searching for it for years and this other person comes and finds it within 2 hours.
Yeah,
but to be the person who finds it within 2 hours would
sick.
Be awesome.
And I will say, I did see the post on our socials, and that was the first I had heard of it. It was pretty cool. So Paula, we are our own news source. My news source.
At least it hit somebody. I like it. The F.J. King was a wooden American canal schooner built in 1867 by George R. Rogers in Toledo, Ohio. She was officially launched on June 16, 1867, and owned by William Griffin and J.S. Dunham. She was built to be used for the grain and iron ore industries around the Great Lakes. The F.J. King was 144 feet long, which is 43.9 meters, had a beam of 26.2 feet, or 8 meters, and a depth of 12 feet, or 3.7 meters. Now, here's an interesting fact. It took about 20 acres of white oak forest to build this ship. You don't usually hear about how many acres it takes to build a ship.
That's insane.
Or a house. Or anything that would take trees. But, yeah. 20 acres. Seems like a lot.
That's a lot of trees.
In total, the F.J. King's gross register tonnage was 280.55 tons, with her net being 266 tons. We covered canal schooners in depth in episode 50, which was entitled A Great Lakes Polly Pocket. But as a quick refresher, these vessels were built to fit within the confines of the Welland Canal while still trying to maximize cargo space. Unfortunately for this canal schooner, the F.J. King was actually built too long to fit in the Welland Canal, and because of this, the corners of her stern had to be cut off in 1869 over a winter layup. The following spring, on March 1st, 1870, the F.J. King was taken to Bailey's Yard in Toledo, Ohio, to be again shortened by 3 feet, or 0.9 meters.
You know, we've all had, like, a project that we've had to do, and you missed, like, one little detail. And it sinks you, you know? Well, that's what it was here.
I love how they're like, oh yeah, we built her to be a canaler, but we built her too long.
Make sure it so fits in the canal, and also make sure it carries a lot. Carries a lot? You got it.
Wait, did you say something else? Something
about a canal. I think this was what the measurements were.
Oh, man. Yeah. Just cut off her corners and then shorten her by 3 feet. So apparently the only picture we have of her is before she had those modifications on her. So this is pre-stern corners being cut off and then pre-3 feet being shortened. Shortened by 3 feet. After her haircut, trim, reconfiguration, the F.J. King seemed to have a relatively uneventful yet lucrative 19 years of service, save one accident where she lost her bowsprit somewhere on Lake Erie on November 2nd, 1871, before running aground at the Black River. She was lightered and towed off with no mentions of repairs being needed, besides, obviously, the bowsprit. In 1873, the F.J. King was outfitted with a new deck, and one source mentioned her being altered with an additional mast, going from a total of 2 to 3 masts. Records then show that she transferred ownership to Captain William Griffin in 1876. Since he was initially a co-owner, perhaps he just bought out his partner. In the same year as her ownership changed, the F.J. King had some major repairs done. Nothing specified, just, quote, major repairs, end quote. She had this again in 1881. In the following year, the F.J. King was towed by the Burlington for some reason. I don't know if I'll include this part, but the source said, quote, in Cleveland and Chicago trade with A.C. Keating, H.F. Church, and O.J. Hale, end quote. Two of those are ships. One's a shipbuilder. I thought maybe she was part of, like, the whole schooner barge.
You can guess which is which.
The A.C. Keating is a shipbuilder. The H.F. Church was a schooner, and the O.J. Hale was a barge. I thought maybe she was, like, acting as a schooner barge with all of them. I don't know. So,
dang it, they caught me.
She's just like hiding in plain sight, like Baylot said. Yeah, so she was towed for some reason in 1882 with a bunch of other boats. So maybe it was a parade. On her last voyage, the F.J. King set out on September 15th, 1886 in the early morning hours. She was headed from Escanaba, Michigan, upbound to Chicago, Illinois. And she was under the command of Captain Griffin, her then owner, and loaded up with a cargo of iron ore. When the F.J. King was passing the Door Peninsula, recall her from last week's episode, she ran into a southwest gale accompanied by 8 to 10 foot waves, which is 2.4 to 3 meters high. She was plowing through the strong wind, but when she was just off of Sturgeon Bay, the weather caught up to her. The storm and waves were too much for the old hull of the F.J. King.
Much too much.
For the old hull of the F.J. King, and she sprung a leak. The crew rushed to pump out the rapidly waterlogging hull. Captain Griffin decided to turn. Just skipping over words. Fast forwarding in my head. Captain Griffin decided to try and turn, running with the wind instead of into it and putting in at North Bay. However, about 5 miles or 8 kilometers out of North Bay, the wind finally subsided, but the large rolling waves brutally rocked the F.J. King. The water coming into the hull was getting worse, and the crew of 8 could not keep up with it. Captain Griffin saw no way out with the ship still intact, so he finally gave the order to abandon the sinking vessel. The entire crew and captain made it onto the schooner's yawl, and around 2 a.m., as they rowed toward shore, they witnessed the F.J. King's final moments. The ship sank bow first, quote, with her aft deckhouse being blown about 50 feet or 15.2 meters into the air as she went down, end quote. Another source mentioned that her stern deckhouse was actually blown away in the storm and not blown up, and that the captain's papers were the ones being blown into the air. The latter seems a little bit more believable, that it was blown away instead of blown up, but we'd have talked about before, like, the air becoming compressed when it, you know, sinks and causing
explosions. I feel like a explosions. Ship like this is not that watertight or airtight, especially. Mm. So yeah. I personally kind of think I lean more so towards blowing what makes away. Sense to me. I'm not saying it's correct, but just the wind is, you know, it just sort of off and away it goes.
Yeah, that's what I think. And then the papers are the ones being like blown up into the air. But yeah,
my uneducated guess.
a whole deckhouse not exploding off like 50 feet in the air. That's quite significant. Not long after, with some sources saying that the ship was standing by to help, the crew was picked up by another schooner, Le Petit, who took them to Bailey's Harbor, Wisconsin. A few days after the sinking of the F.J. King, Captain W.A. Sanderson, keeper of the Canna Island Lighthouse, reported that the tops of the sunken ship's masts were poking out of the water. He noted especially that since the main shipping lane was nearby, the spars were a potential danger to other ships and their navigation. A government revenue cutter named the Andrew Johnson was sent out to the wreck site to remove the top of the masts. After this was accomplished, the sea lane was again safe for shipping, and the F.J. King was lost to time. And a government revenue cutter is a typically armed government vessel used for maritime law enforcement, and have been around since the formation of the United States Revenue Cutter Service in 1790, and were sort of like a pre-Coast Guard. Despite everyone's best efforts, the F.J. King was missing for almost 139 years. She was so elusive that the F.J. King earned a reputation as a ghost ship. Maritime historian and president of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association, Brendan Baylod, led a group from the WUAA along with his longtime research partner, Bob Jake. If they sound familiar, it's because we've covered these two before, as they seem to be on quite the wreck-finding streak with the steamer L.W. Crane in the Fox River in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Earlier this year, the tug John Evanson and the schooner Margaret A. Muir in 2024, and we covered Margaret A. Muir in episode 48, as well as the schooner Trinidad in 2023, which was episode 56 of ours. Or maybe we just like covering their ships, so... They found a lot, and we've covered probably most of those.
I think that's well said.
Thanks. Thanks for your contribution. Stop, let me breathe. When the group located the F.J. King, she was in about 137 feet of water, or 41.8 meters, located near Bailey's Harbor, a small town on Wisconsin's Door Peninsula. Baylod later recalled the actual finding, saying, quote, "We kind of saw this big, dark object coming, starting materializing, and all of a sudden, we saw hatches, a deck, and we could see a bow and a stern," end quote. Bela told the Washington Post that the group included 20 citizen scientists and community historians who were all searching for the F.J. King. Bela went on to say, quote, "We thought, what a fun search. We're not going to probably find it, but every rock you run over, it'll get your pulse going, you know," end quote. But, as we know now, they did find it.
It's the small things, you know.
Thanks. Like the peanut gallery over there.
Just, I don't have a lot to contribute. Commentary. I'll have some commentary here and there. I just love the quote of, like, we saw this big dark object coming, start to materialize. All of a sudden, we saw hatches, a deck, a bow, and a stern. I was just thinking, like, heck, that's half a boat right there.
What more do you need?
I mean, you got the makings.
It's just a rock that's shaped like a boat. That'd be funny.
That would be tragic.
Not to them, but funny to look back on once they found it, you know? Just 2 hours into the search trip, an unusual shape appeared on our side scan sonar system. Baylod said, quote, a few of us had to pinch each other. After all the previous searches, we couldn't believe we had actually found it, and so quickly, end quote. Especially since, despite looking for the ship, this trip was mainly to focus on learning about the sonar and remotely operated vehicle, ROV, equipment used to find shipwrecks. So it's kind of like a training session, but also like, oh, we might as well look for a ship while we're out here. And then, boom, they found a ship. Lesson over.
You know, you might as well just, there's no better practice than doing the real thing, you know?
That's fair. That's very fair. Dan, it's either Clevine or Cleween. I'm going to say Clevine because I think that's where it showed up the most. But Dan Clevine, a citizen scientist, was controlling the submersible drone that was launched. He said, quote, visibility was very poor, and we weren't sure if we were going to find the FJ King. And all of a sudden, it just popped into broad view. Just timbers of a vessel, and wow, we got a wreck. The excitement was just shared by everyone that we had actual visual contact of it and were able to identify it as the FJ King, end quote.
That measurements would be just, like, incredible. Like, such an incredible feeling and moment.
Yeah, just, you hope to see things, and I'm sure your brain plays tricks on you. Kind of what Baylod was saying with stones. Like, you'll see a rock, and you're like, oh my gosh, this might be it, and it's just a rock. But to have it actually be a ship, like, that's so cool. Measurements were taken, and they matched the known dimensions of the FJ King. A remotely operated underwater vehicle was quickly launched in order to capture photos and videos of the shipwreck. This was the first time anyone had seen her in over a century. Prior to this, she was one of the most highly sought-after shipwrecks in Lake Michigan. The elusiveness of the ship was mainly due to no clear clues being written about her loss, along with conflicting reports of where the location of the ship's final resting place may be. There was even a dive club, the Green Bay-based Neptune's Dive Club, in the 1970s, who issued a $1,000 reward for her discovery, which is just over $8,000 today with inflation. The reward was presented to Baylod, I think, at $1,000. They capped it, but he'll be using it for future citizen science projects. With how violently the FJ King went down, it was assumed that her hull would show signs of significant damage. But unlike a lot of older wooden vessels who sink while carrying heavy loads, the FJ King's hull was surprisingly fairly intact and sitting upright. For one of the participants of the expedition, Kevin McConaughey, this trip was his first time out on a boat in the Great Lakes. He mentioned really feeling like he was part of the FJ King story after seeing the lighthouse and then the wreck show up on his screen, adding that, quote, I have a new hobby now, end quote.
That's insane. Talk about a memorable first time out on the Great Lakes.
Yes, but I keep thinking, like, he's going to expect this for every trip out.
Yeah, every
subsequent trip. And it's a new hobby.
Man, this sucks. Like, what is this? Give me another shipwreck.
Every other trip, every other search, like shipwreck search party, is not going to be quite as exciting because finding a shipwreck within 2 hours, very rare. But yeah, what a way to start! What an introduction to the Great Lakes.
Quite memorable.
Before embarking on this trip, Baylod had exhaustively researched the FJ King, poring over hundreds of historical documents about the ship and her sinking. There were also accounts of fishermen hauling up bits and pieces of the wreck scattered over an area of several miles throughout the years. Two records especially stood out to him. One was a report Captain Griffin had filed after the sinking of the wreck with the Oswegatchie Customs House, where the ship was enrolled. In this report, he mentioned that the FJ King had sunk about 5 miles from shore, or 8 kilometers, in about 150 feet of deep water, or 45.7 meters. The second document that really stood out to Baylod was a report from William Sanderson, the lighthouse keeper from the nearby Canna Island Lighthouse that we mentioned. He was the one who had initially reported the schooner's mast sticking out of the water and causing a shipping hazard, almost a slipping hazard. Baylod figured, quote, we reasoned that the captain may not have known where he was in the 2 a.m. darkness, but the lighthouse keeper's course and distance to the mast were probably accurate, end quote. Quote, it was about a year ago that I found this account. I was reinvestigating the wreck from the ground up. That's what I do. I start from scratch using only primary sources, and I sort of rebuild the history of the wreck, end quote, Baylod told Fox 11 News. Supposing this, Baylot created a 2-square-mile search grid around the location reported by Lighthouse Keeper Sanderson, and when the group found the F.J. King's wreck, she was on the lake floor less than half a mile from where Sanderson had described seeing her.
That is phenomenal on the Lighthouse Keeper's job. Like, I mean, yeah. They don't have much else to do other than to know their job. Like, they're just there doing their job. But, like, that is still phenomenal
deafened
work.
By foghorns, yes. Apparently.
Yeah, imagine having to do your job after being blasted by foghorns constantly, pretty much, you know? But, like,
yes.
It's just, that's just mind-blowing to me. Way to go, Lighthouse Keeper Sanderson, back in the day.
Yes, no, definitely. And, I mean, yeah, I bet the captain wrote down what he knew what was going on. But, yeah, and the disorientation and darkness of it all, like, he's traveling through this area versus Lighthouse Keeper, like, this is his domain, this is what he's kind of in control of and stuff. But yeah, wild stuff. And if you don't know what we're talking about with deafening lighthouses, listen to last week's episode. The discovery,
it's a real
of the...
hoot and a blast. I'm late to the game there.
I can cut down that's fine. The discovery
it'll
of the
hopefully
FJ...
light up your day.
Wow. Any more from the peanut gallery? Found a spot. No pressure. He's burning
It'll be a nice walk to a new adventure and educational experience.
That was a stretch. I'm gonna let you recover from that stretch. The discovery of the F.J. King was reported to the Wisconsin Historical Society, who then sent down divers to both document the shipwreck and to create a 3D model of it. We'll post the link to the 3D model on our socials. Andrew can just click the little hyperlink there. Done by the talented and previously mentioned Zach Whitrock. Pretty cool to see. I'm impressed how quickly they've put this together. The wreck of the F.J. King continues to rest in the waters of Lake Michigan, about 70 miles or 112.7 kilometers northeast of Green Bay. She is covered in invasive quagga mussels, but still quite well preserved. In fact, she's touted as being one of the best, if not the best preserved wrecks in Door County waters. Unfortunately, the increasing infestation of the invasive mussels are causing shipwreck hunters to search the Great Lakes with more urgency as of late, out of concern that the mussels are destroying the wrecks and will soon disintegrate any evidence we have left. This is also making now, or current times, being referred to by some people as the golden age for shipwreck discoveries. Talk about job security for us. Also, there's evidence that, being the nautical time capsule she is, the F.J. King still contains all of her articles she was lost with back in 1886. And that'd be pretty cool to see if it's possible. So maybe when more pictures come out, later on, the F.J. King will be nominated for a listing on Wisconsin State and National Registers of Historic Places. When she is placed on the registers, the location of the F.J. King will be disclosed to the public. Kevin Collin, director of the Wisconsin Maritime Museum, told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, quote, "We found a piece of history that has been written about and forgotten, and now it can come back to life," end quote. And that is the story of the F.J. King, who was just recently discovered a few months ago and just released to the public last month.
Fantastic.
A few weeks ago.
I'm looking at the 3D model right now, and it is really wild. Like, there's the anchor is still hanging on the side. Like, it's really quite phenomenal.
It's quite detailed, because, yeah, some of the pictures, it's definitely a little blurry. I mean, you can kind of tell what's what. To an extent, I think one of this is the base of a mast and this is the bow, and you can kind of see the anchor. But yeah, the 3D model kind of definitely clears it up for sure.
No, that's pretty sweet.
I can't wait to hear how many scratches and taps there are from this dog on my side.
There'll be some barking on my side.
Well, we'll see what happens. There. Yours is right in time for it to like get really loud on my side.
All right, well, last week's trivia, the world's first official lighthouse built around 280 BCE was a 450-foot tall structure that was considered one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. It was called Egypt's Pharos of Alexandria.
You said that better than I did when I first read it.
Thank you.
And people, we're just going to have to deal with dogs. It is a very dog day of fall over on this
Once it starts to be colder weather or whatever else, hopefully it'll bring the dogs in. It'll be a little quieter. So since then, lighthouses have come a long way, but before more modern technology, what used to be done in order to help guide ships to and around shores? Answer: before the actual towers of lighthouses, the houses of light, sailors would use man-made piles of rocks as daymarks to see the shoreline and troublesome areas during the day. But after dark, it was a different story. If volcanoes were in the area, the glow from the lava would help guide mariners. And if no volcanoes were handy, you know, not everyone's so lucky and fortunate, bonfires were lit along the shore, as well as in metal baskets called braziers.
It looks very close to another word.
Yes. But these were lit and placed in specific locations. In fact, in Ireland, lit braziers were being used as early as the 5th century, assuming that's CE and not BCE, but we're a little bit unclear about that. And if you want to shoot for the stars and earn some bonus points, what were the other 6 wonders of the ancient world? Number 1, Lighthouse of Alexandria, which is in Egypt, and we covered this briefly, but it was one of the tallest man-made structures of its time and served as a navigational aid for ships. The Colossus of Rhodes, or in over in Greece, huge bronze statue of the Greek sun god Helios that stood over the harbor of Rhodes. Mausoleum at Halicarnassus. Yeah, in
Way
Turkey.
To go.
Thank you. It's a monumental tomb built for Mausolus.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's where mausoleum comes from, which I had no clue.
A satrap, which is a provincial governor in the Persian Empire.
Persian? You ever heard like a Persian cat?
Yeah, but I forget what word my mind was trying to go to. Like
Parisian? Like
yeah,
Paris?
That's what it was, yes. there's the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus, which is also in Turkey. It's a grand temple dedicated to the Greek goddess of the hunt, Artemis. Number 5, statue of Zeus at Olympia in Greece, which is a giant seated statue of the Greek god Zeus, made out of ivory and gold. I almost said a giant sealed statue. I don't know what a sealed statue would be.
Ar.
Exactly. Number 6, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon in Iraq. A series of terraced gardens described as a remarkable feat of ancient irrigation. Number 7, the Great Pyramid of Giza in Egypt. The only surviving ancient wonder and was a tomb built for the pharaoh Khufu. And this week's trivia is skippity skip skip for now.
I love when you just read what I write. Don't look ahead.
Yep. I saw it, I was always, like, there we go.
Whenever we do the Wisconsin Archaeological Underwater Association or Underwater Archaeological Association, I always think of that one time, the first time where I had you say woo-ah for it. Cracks me up.
Good old
They're
a
very serious organization, but it was so funny.
Anyway, grace us with you. Yeah, I'm happy. It makes you happy. Grace us with your lovely presence next week for more Great Lakes and Shipwreck Adventures. I heard a rumor that we have a good one coming up for you, and we don't want you to miss it. In the meantime, don't be shy. Send us an email at underthewavespodcast@gmail.com. Make sure you tap that like or save button when you're checking out this week's photos in our Instagram at Under the Waves Podcast and Facebook Under the Waves Podcast, as well as hit those follow and 5-star buttons on your favorite listening platform. If you're interested in today's sources, they can be found on our website, www.underthewavespodcast.com. We thank you, we love you, and in case you haven't heard today or recently, you're doing great and we're proud of you.
Share this with a morning person in your life. You didn't think that just because we are more night owl leaning people that we would forget about our early bird counterparts, did you? Tsk tsk. We're talking about those who text you a cheery good morning at 5:37 a.m. like it's a reasonable hour. And no, they didn't just schedule the text ahead. They really are awake, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, waiting eagerly for your response, like it's not the middle of the night and you're still peacefully drooling on your pillow. These people are always mentioning that they just feel more productive in the mornings. What they really mean is that they've already worked out, had a full and complete breakfast, answered 3 emails, folded all their laundry, and brushed your teeth all before you've poured your first cup of coffee. It's slightly enviable how these morning people get to exist in and relish the time before the world wakes up, getting to enjoy every single sunrise, and don't have to wake up groggy and disoriented to do so. These sunrise show-offs are the equivalent of the motivational posters you see in doctor's offices, painfully optimistic, slightly unsettling, and just a little bit smug. I guess they've earned it by being able to wake up before the sun does, but do they really have to rub it in your sleep-deprived face? So yes, share this episode with your resident worm hunter, your 6 a.m. yoga warrior, your I-love-the-smell-of-dew-on-the-grass enthusiast, and just know that by 8 p.m. tonight, they're going to be fast asleep while your day is just getting to the good part. And while we're questioning things, why is it that these two types of people seem to attract each other? It's just making it so that the afternoons are really the only agreeable time to hang out. Perhaps just share this with someone who is awake as you pass through the day.
We release new episodes every Friday. And until then, fair winds and following seas.
We'll catch you next time under the waves. Bye.
Cheers.
And good night.
And good morning.
I think I read this too fast.
Yeah, it's fine.